You. It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. While we wait for vehicles that get better mileage than today's current models, there are a steadfast group of people trying to squeeze every possible mile out of a gallon of gasoline. They're called hypermilers. They tell us that using their driving techniques can often match the mileage of a person driving an equivalent hybrid. A bold boast, and we'll meet the self-proclaimed king of the hypermilers later in the program. Before we get to the art of driving, however, let's get to some real art. Although she isn't a queen, she does have the name of a former Queen of England, and she is the recipient of an OBE, making her an officer of the Order of the British Empire. But you know her from her work as an actress in film and on television, including her long-running stint as Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. But Jane Seymour is also a painter, and she's in Charlotte to kick off an exhibition of her work tonight at South Park. Fortunately for us, she joins us for part of the program this morning. Welcome to Charlotte. Nice to see you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You can't possibly remember this, but back in the days when you were doing Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, I was working for a CBS radio station, and we talked via satellite for a few minutes back then. It was a thrill for me then. It's really a thrill now because I can look at you.
Well, there you go.
Jane Seymour is our official on-the-scene correspondent from the Democratic National Convention. We have just adopted her because she just returned.
I was there.
From the convention.
Yes.
And you were there to talk about
water, yes. I did a documentary that's coming out on public television all over the country, so you just have to look and see. It's called Are We Running Dry? Mm-hmm. The Southwest, the American Southwest. I did another one as well called Running Dry about the global water issues. But it's really quite terrifying, and it's something that people haven't really realized, you know, what a big crisis it is. But for example, in Arizona, Utah, and California, and Nevada, all those places, they're just running out of water. Mm. I mean, and meanwhile, you know, they've got fountains in Las Vegas that are going up in the sky, and they've got musical accompaniment and everything. And meanwhile, they've pretty much drained the Colorado River and the aquifers underneath. So it's really kind of a call to action, what we can do and what we should do. And 40% of the Navajo Nation, for example, the people who live on the Navajo Nation have no water at all. They have to drive 10 miles to get water and then pay for it. So there are some things in this country that are so sad.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to
politely put.
Yeah, so I went to the Democratic National Convention and I got hold of some pretty big players there, and gave them my documentary, and I think things are going to happen.
Okay. How did you get hooked up with the environment? I'm actually curious more about how you got hooked up with the West. Here you are, a girl from England.
Yes.
And, of course, you've done a lot of things, but for most Americans, we think of you as Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. So you spent a lot of time, 7 years, shooting that TV show in the American West.
Yes.
If I were you, when that show was over, I'd be running as far away from the dirt and the heat and the cactus as I possibly could. But you're still out there doing this.
Well, clearly you haven't been to Malibu recently. I haven't seen any dirt, heat, or cactus there. It's a pretty stunning place, and
I think a lot of people
live there for a reason. A lot of my paintings actually reflect exactly where I live, and people go, "Where's that?" And I go, "My backyard." It's really not so bad. You know, there's the dolphins, the whales, the pelicans, beautiful ocean, and then behind me are mountains, and we grow everything from roses to everything grows there.
I mean, Malibu is
organic
stunning.
Gardening is one of our big things. You know, we grow all our own food. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a stunning place. There's
not as elegant as Charlotte.
You're being kind.
Well, we try to copy your architecture in Beverly Hills, and
they miss.
They definitely miss. Yes,
we have architecture. All right, let me write that down, because we're often accused of not having any architecture, or certainly no appreciation for. Although the city skyline,
is stunning, and those those beautiful mansions, they're just gorgeous.
Yeah. You mentioned painting, and that really is why you're here.
Yes.
How did it start for you? When did you first put brush to canvas?
Well, when I was a little girl, I used to paint and draw all the time. It was my favorite pastime. It's just something I always loved to do. And for some reason, I just naturally was able to see something, and and somehow be able to, you know, put it up, put it down. I know that's just a natural thing. And I studied art when I was in high school. I could have gone to college with it, but at that time I really wanted to be a ballerina. So I didn't go to college. I tried to become a ballerina, injured myself, and by accident became an actress. So now, many, many years later, about 17 years ago, I went through a terrible divorce. I lost everything. I lost my homes. I lost all my money. I was, it was pretty dire circumstances. And instead of having a nervous breakdown, I ended up painting.
I also read that you bought something in that period of your life when you had no money left. You bought something at a charity auction?
I did. I attended a charity auction for a charity that I work with anyway called Child Help USA, which is the child abuse agency I'm very involved with. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go bankrupt, I might as well give some of this money, whatever's in my pocket here, you know, away to a good cause. So I gave some to Child Help in return for an artist to do a drawing of my children. And when the artist came to my house and saw the finger paintings that I'd been doing with my kids, you know, hanging up in the playroom, and he said, whose are those? And who did them? And I said, I did. He said, they're really good. I laughed. I said, they're finger paintings. He said, no, they're really good. He said, you know, do you paint? And so I told him how I hadn't painted for years, and he gave me a couple of free lessons.
Describe those finger paintings, because obviously he saw something in them that was
very free, very colorful, with a lot of fingerprints. No, they were kind of imaginary landscapes. They were pretty happy looking. I mean, obviously I was doing it with my kids and, you know, full of primary colors, but I obviously very free. And I think he then decided to teach me watercolor technique. And the first ones I did were very calm and very pale and very traditional. But then I just got carried away and I just played with color. And I think, you know, I paint in a lot of different mediums. I paint a lot of different subjects and a lot of different styles. So, you know, really, really different. And people are, you know, when they look at it, the one thing they do notice is they're happy and there's a lot of use of color. Hmm. I'm very much a colorist. I can paint abstract. I can also paint impressionism. I also paint realism, sometimes really almost photorealism. But the thing that I really love is color. That's the big thing for me.
Does your talent as an artist surprise you? I mean, because you started out wanting to be a ballet dancer, then you became a very successful actress. So does it surprise you that you can do this, or does it just, is it just part of the creative soul that you obviously have?
Well, it's something I did for me. I mean, I never imagined anyone would ever look at these paintings, and I certainly never imagined I'd make as many of them as I have. But what happened is when I first started doing it, people loved the paintings, and they wanted to buy them, and they wanted to have them, and they wanted them on T-shirts, and they wanted them on coffee mugs, and they wanted them on, you know, fabrics. And the next thing I knew, I was raising a lot of money for charity with them. I mean, we raised a lot of money at the Guggenheim for Make-A-Wish Foundation with one of my first paintings, which was put on a Discover card. So I realized that I could actually communicate very personally rather than just playing characters, which I love to do. I love acting. Mm-hmm. But when I paint, I'm really communicating my feelings and my response, emotional response, to what's around me in my life. And I realized that I could actually say a great deal with paintings. I mean, for example, right now, we were talking earlier about the water issue. I have a painting of a little girl from Bangalore in India, and you can just see her. She's caught at the moment. She's, you know, got the rusty tap, and she's, you know, picking up a pail of water that she's obviously going to walk another 5 miles to take to a village. And it kind of tells the story. And so it's a privilege as an artist to be able to tell stories on canvas or on paper, as well as, of course, you know, in the cinema.
And you mentioned that you paint in a lot of different mediums, but you started with watercolor. And I don't know much about painting, but I do know that watercolor is exquisitely unforgiving.
It is, and that's what I love about it. Because the beauty of watercolor is that you can't control it. You can try, but it becomes muddy very easily.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of, and it's actually sort of a great metaphor for life, watercolor, because you have your intention and then you put the color out there, especially if you work wet on wet, and then you have to let go of it at some point and you have to kind of roll with it. So rather like in life, you have intentions, you train, you practice, you have an idea of what it is you want to do or a goal. And then when you actually go in the real world and you try and make that happen, real life happens. Mm. And so it's the people who can roll with change and move and really communicate and be in the present moment that succeed in everything they do. And I think the same thing with watercolor.
Okay. I was going to say that that's what makes a good actor.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you can learn those lines a million times, take a trillion lessons, but unless you're listening to the person you're acting with and taking in the environment you're in and allowing yourself to turn it over, as we call it,
right,
or just fly or whatever it is you call it. I actually refer to it as sort of having an open heart, which is another thing I was going to talk about.
Yes.
My abstract, I came up with an abstract image of really how I feel about life. I feel that when your heart is open, love will always find a way in. That this, for example, this necklace I'm wearing is based on some of the paintings I've done where there are two hearts and they're open and they're linked, they're connected. So, for example, if you're in a relationship, you connect very strongly. But if your heart is open and your partner's heart is open, you know, they have room to breathe and grow and become and experience their own life while still being connected to you. And, I can go on forever about this. I've just written a book that's coming out at the end of the year with Running Press called Open Hearts. And that sort of explains it
and
better.
This piece of jewelry that you're wearing around your neck.
I did exclusively.
Sold.
Thank you. It's diamonds and white gold, this particular one. But there's 43 different designs in the collection, and they start at $39 in sterling silver.
Wow.
And I decided to do it with K Jewelers. So if you go to K.com or JaneSeymour.com and look for Jane Seymour's Open Hearts, you can see it there.
You know, you're an industry, aren't you? I mean, you are. You're an actress. You are a designer. I know you've designed sets.
I designed sets and costumes. You're right, for the Houston Ballet. And
handbags.
I design handbags, silk scarves, a whole home collection, women's clothing. And I also public speak. And
write books?
And I write books.
Where does this come from? What is it about you or your formative years as a child or a young adult or whatever? Where does this come from? What set you up for this kind of a life?
I think, obviously, first of all, it had to be my parents, and both of whom survived World War II.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was in a concentration camp for 3.5 years in a Japanese camp in Indonesia. And my father actually opened the gates of Bergen-Belsen and had lost some of his relatives there. So, and my father served in the Royal Air Force. So when I grew up, I think my parents were so grateful to be alive and to have freedom that, you know, we had no money, but they gave us everything. I mean, they took us to museums. We'd walk around the city of London and look at the architecture. We'd listen to the opera. We'd go to the ballet. I mean, we wouldn't sit in the good seats. We'd sit up in the back. And so I kind of was infused with the arts. And at the same time, my parents were very much public servants. My father worked in the National Health. He very rarely charged a lot of his patients if they couldn't afford it. He was an OBGYN.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a volunteer in the Red Cross and also worked with the child abuse agencies raised money for them in England, the NSPCC. So that was really very much my background. And they had three daughters. I'm the eldest. And we were just raised to believe we could be whatever we wanted to be. And they couldn't afford the ballet shoes I needed for my ballet school. So I realized that I could knit and I could embroider. So I embroidered blouses and sold them at the best boutique in London. That was when I was 15. And I had a whole business in clothing and embroideries and knitwear and things like that. I mean, but no one worked for me. It was just me. I designed them, I made them, and I sold them. And I used that money to subsidize my ballet career. So I've been doing this forever. And then I had a near-death experience a number of years ago when I was playing Maria Callas. And when I actually left my body and I saw that my body was this, like a car, I was me, but I wasn't in there, and I saw the white light, and I saw the people resuscitating me as well, I just realized you take nothing with you but the difference you may have made and the love you may have shared. So that's it.
Jane Seymour is our guest. We have much more to talk about in just a very little bit of time. We'll come back in just a moment. Our program is made possible in part today by the Southern Kitchen and Bath Show, September 5th through 7th at the Charlotte Merchandise Mart, featuring ideas, information, and experts on the latest in appliances, kitchens, and baths. Details at southernshows.com. And by Catawba Lands Conservancy, presenting Land Conservation Celebration, an outdoor celebration with music, games, hikes, and more, open to the public on Saturday, May 31st. Event details at catawbalands.org. There are a lot of myths floating out there, you know. Should you truly feed a cold or starve a fever? How many glasses of water should you really drink every day? Is it 8, really? I mean, does turkey make you sleepy? Really? Does it really do that? If you use your cell phone in a hospital, are you really endangering other patients? We're going to find out Monday. We're going to repeat a show we did back in January. And if you didn't hear it, you'll have a chance to do it on Monday at 9 because we explode a lot of myths and bring in some new information that maybe you didn't know.
The Friday News Roundup. Democratic nominee Barack Obama delivers his acceptance speech in Denver as Republicans gear up for their convention in St. Paul next week. As the general election kicks into high gear, analysis of the campaigns and each candidate's vice presidential picks. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday.
After Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Renee Montaigne. As we've progressed through this election season, Morning Edition has been there, bringing you the latest from the campaign trail.
Hope is what led me here today.
We sure showed them what a comeback looks like.
As we get closer to November 4th, you can count on us to continue that coverage. For news about the 2008 election, tune in to Morning Edition from NPR News.
With regional news, weather, and traffic, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today in this segment of the program is actress Jane Seymour, painter Jane Seymour, who is in town to exhibit some of her works at the Wentworth Gallery at South Park. She'll actually be there in person. You can meet her tonight from 6 to 9 and tomorrow from 6 to 9 in the evening at South Park Mall. And although we only have about 10 minutes left with Jane, if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or you can email us quickly at charlottetalks@wfae.org. I went to your website, your painting website, yesterday just to look through your work and to see what your paintings looked like, and I know that those paintings at South Park are not even on the website.
They're much newer ones.
But
yes.
what I noticed about it is you're not cemented to one style. There's impressionism in there. There's realism in there. There's all kinds of different. Why?
Well, I think the same way you can ask me as an actress, you know, what makes me think I could be a comedian now. You know, when I've been playing ingenues, when I was the time for ingenues, romance, then I played very evil people, like East of Eden and Murder in the Mirror or whatever. And then I, you know, played very vulnerable people like War and Remembrance and Dr. Quinn. And, you know, I play so many different characters. And as an actress, I like to try and play different material. And in the same way as an artist, you know, I look at different images and this, I'm inspired in different ways. Plus, I like to grow.
Yeah.
I want to try new things. And I also sculpt, but I haven't brought any sculpture with me.
There were several paintings in there that talked about Monet's garden. And I've been to Monet's garden, and it's exactly how I remember it.
Well, thank you. You know, what I did is I got this model to pose for me, and I thought, well, who would be the best model for me to pose, so get to pose that would actually embody the spirit that I'm looking for? And then I went, I guess me. So, I ran behind a bush. It was the day that the gardens were closed, and I put on some period clothes, and I stood there on the bridge. I was allowed to sit in the boat. And my husband filmed me there in Monet's gardens. So we actually have a film of this. And then I took a ton of photographs that were ideas for paintings. And my husband downloaded them and lost every single one.
Oh.
So I had to paint not only from memory, but from still moments from the video that he took, from the film that he took. So those Monet pieces are either from my imagination or based upon me being filmed there.
I also noticed that your signature on the paintings changes from painting to painting. It would make it very difficult for collectors to take these to Antiques Roadshow in about 100 years and verify who actually did them.
Well, no, not really. Because if I've painted in oil painting on the painting, that is what happens with the brush. But I have a very flamboyant signature that's my either a pencil or a pen or, you know, on orange éclairs. I mean, anything where I have a pen, it's much freer. Mm-hmm. And to be perfectly honest, I've got to figure this out because when I use a brush, it never comes out the way I want to because you have to kind of print almost. You can't really sign and, I should probably shorten my name or just put JS or something there, but I think then collectors would be really pissed off. So,
but you've already shortened your name.
Yes, I have shortened it from Joyce Penelope Wilhelmina Frankenberg. Yes, I was.
How did you choose Jane Seymour? Because she was a queen of England.
I mean. No, I picked the name Jane because I figured if I was going to change anything, I would keep that initial, and I wasn't crazy about the name Joyce.
Yeah.
I can't remember why, but Jane, whatever. And, and my agent came up with the name Jane Seymour, and it, you know, the idea was something easy to spell, easy to remember, and English-sounding. And, of course, we all forgot that it was Henry VIII's third wife, and mercifully everybody else did. So producers and directors would say, yes, I've seen her, I've heard of her. Either that or I've seen her at a party or something. But anyway, they were convinced they knew me, but they didn't know why.
Very clever.
And so it worked very well.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, so I always tell people my real name, though.
Let's talk to a couple of people who are on the phone here. Sam in Pineville, welcome to the program. You're on with Jane Seymour.
Thank you. I was just curious how Ms. Seymour's work as a stage and film actress has influenced her visual arts.
Good question.
Actually, it's a good question. It has, because I paint a great deal when I'm filming. So a lot of my paintings are actually the sets that I'm sitting on and the environments that I'm in when I'm painting and when I'm working as an actress. And also I paint myself. I paint self-portraits as different characters. I am also very influenced because when I'm filming, invariably I'm doing period pieces or in great locations. And it becomes inspiration for new images.
I see. Does your visual art influence your acting as well?
I think it does. I think the freer I got as an artist, the freer I became as an actress. I think I'm hitting my stride now at last. I think instead of worrying about, so much about, how I look or whether I got something right, I think I'm being much freer and much more kind of experimenting and trying different things. I mean, if you see I have a show on tonight on Hallmark Channel called Dear Prudence, and it's a completely different character from anything I've ever played, and people seem to love it. They've already asked me to do two more of them, but it's giving me, I'm kind of acting with broader strokes.
The Dear Prudence sounds a little bit like Murder, She Wrote Younger. Because it's described by TV Guide as a workaholic advice guru becomes involved in a murder investigation during vacation. Here you are in the West again at a Wyoming lodge. She meets two suitors, but one may have something to hide.
Well, but if you really watch the movie, which maybe this person hasn't done, in fact, I can guarantee it, they'll know that it's very tongue in cheek. The whole thing's very funny.
Is there a series in this, you think? They're asking you to come back for two or
three
more.
They have already asked me to do that, and they're sending me to MIPCOM, so it's already been sold foreign as well.
You also told – thank you for your call, Sam, by the way. You also told TV Guide that you did this movie because you were tired of being the cougar du jour.
I'm not tired. I love being cougar. I said my husband was tired of me being cougar du jour. You know, you get misquoted a lot in this business.
We have a clip of you being a cougar du jour. A kind of Mrs. Robinson type cougar du jour in the movie Wedding Crashers with Owen Wilson in this scene. And I'd like to play a little bit of that and have you talk about it for just a couple of seconds. This is Jane Seymour in Wedding Crashers.
I just had my stuff. You like them?
Those seem like lovely.
William doesn't give a about my.
Well, darn him. But Mrs. Cleary, this is pretty sudden.
You've been playing cat and mouse with me ever since you came here.
Mrs. Cleary, I don't...
Call me cat.
Okay, cat.
Call me kitty cat.
Okay, kitty cat. This feels borderline inappropriate.
Feel them.
What?
I said feel them.
Mrs. Cleary.
Kitty cat.
I'm sorry, kitty cat. Are you out of your mind?
I'm not letting you out of this room until you feel.
Yeah, they feel really nice. Real orb-like. It's amazing what they can do.
Pervert.
That's truly funny.
It's really good on radio. I've never heard it on radio before. I've always been confused by the actual visual image, but clearly it works really well.
It's much better. It's much better when you see it. But I got to tell you, I have to ask you how that was filmed.
How that was filmed?
Yes. Are you actually standing there with Owen Wilson looking at you? Is that a body double?
No,
it was me.
Are
they cutting around you? I mean, what's going on there? How could you do it?
Well, I first of all, when I read the script, I went, oh, I can't do this. Then I read it again. I went, this is the funniest thing I've ever read. It's a shame I can't do this. The third time I read it, I said, I have to do this. There must be a way. Anyway, I had to audition for it, and I beat out a lot of other actors. Can you believe there was a lot of competition for that silly little part? And they said to me they actually had no interest in actually ever seeing the front of me, but would I be prepared to play the scene standing that way? And I said, absolutely, so long as we close the set and you can guarantee that you won't see the front. And they kept their promise. So it was people
but
keep
Owen
rewinding
did.
This.
But thing. Owen did.
Well, I'm not going to tell you entirely about Owen, but Owen Owen was definitely mystified, uncomfortable.
Which adds to the
role. And so was I, which adds to the whole thing. And it was actually very funny. The whole experience ended up being quite funny.
You also did a stint on Dancing with the Stars, and I know you have a dancing background, but was that fun for you? Because it seems to me, I'm not quite understanding why stars go on that show, because they're doing something that's out of their normal element, and they have the risk of being voted off by the viewers. Boo! Get off the show. Why do you do that? Why would you do it?
Well, you know what I wasn't going to do? I turned it down a million times, and my husband said, why would you do this? You know, you're a working actress. You don't need this.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do it so they can sort of resuscitate a career or something, but that was not the reason I was doing it. I did it for two reasons. The biggest one was that as a little kid, as you heard, I always wanted to dance, and I had to stop 40 years ago. I haven't danced in 40 years, but it was my original dream, my original passion. And you get to a point in your life, especially in your midlife, and you just go, you know, oh, I wish I could have, or I never did that, you know, this would have been fun. And it occurred to me that I'd never done ballroom dancing ever, so this would be amazing. But I had a bad back, you know. It just was not on the cards.
Your mother passed away.
That my mother had a stroke, and she was unable to move or talk. And when I told her over the telephone that I'd been asked to do this, she said the only word she spoke in 9 months, she said, yes. And that was it. So my sisters and the nurses in the nursing home, they said, you're going to have to do this. And they said, Mom, you know, Mommy, you just said yes. You know, you spoke. She went, mm-hmm. That was the only, and so that was it. So I did it, and I knew I would probably never see her again, because I knew that she was going to die fairly soon, and I'd already pretty much said my goodbyes, but you can never say goodbye enough to someone you love. And, you know, it was just a very tough time in my life. All I can say is thank God for the Dancing with the Stars, because it allowed me to, it gave me this gift. I think my mom gave me the gift. She just knew how much dancing had meant to me, and that I had never been able to do it. And that here, you know, this was my gift. Now, at the age of 57, with a bad back, I was going to learn something I've never done before in 4 days and perform it in front of the entire world. And, you know, the amazing thing that's come out of it is people of all ages, I mean, it wasn't so much they voted me off, they voted me on. I mean, nobody expected me to last as long as I did. I mean, I don't have a following like a Marie Osmond. I'm just little old Jane Seymour. But it doesn't matter where I go now. I mean, people, all walks of life come up to me and they say, you know, I never watched television, but I watched you on Dancing with the Stars, and I voted. And bless them. Thank you.
I know that we have to let you go, but I'm indulge just one more caller, because he's been holding on for quite a while. Very quickly, Scott in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I tell you, after that last radio play, I'm looking for a cigarette to smoke, and I don't smoke. But seriously, Ms. Seymour, thank you. It's an honor to talk to you, and I've just always enjoyed your career. You played a couple science fiction flicks. You were on Battlestar Galactica, the first series back in the 80s. And then you played a role with Christopher Reeve, the late Christopher Reeve, and I really just enjoyed that movie. And I was wondering if you could just give me insight to how you felt about playing science fiction and then playing the counterpart to Christopher Reeve in the
Somewhere in Time.
Somewhere in Time. Well, I'm in Battlestar Galactica. I did very briefly, but There's a really long story in that one, which I can't really get into right now, but Somewhere in Time is very, very meaningful to me. And Christopher Reeve became one of my closest friends until the day he died. And actually, I have a painting. I have two paintings of me with Christopher Reeve that I've done. So if anyone's interested. But he was a very special man. And I think that's just one of the all-time special romantic movies. A little movie, but a great one.
Scott, thank you for your call. I have to let Miss Seymour go because she has other appointments. But I want to tell everybody that this is a new side of Jane Seymour that you probably have been. I did not know that you were a painter, and I know that there are other people who have been on this program. For instance, Grace Slick, who indulges in visual art, and Tony Bennett, who is a fine painter. And people don't necessarily associate with you with that, but you can go see Jane Seymour's work and meet her tonight from 6 to 9 p.m. and tomorrow night from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Wentworth Gallery at South Park. And if you want to, I suppose you could buy a painting, couldn't you?
yes, that would be the point, they allow that. And I have one of my books is there too, so there's a great giftable item there too.
Thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Jane Seymour, our guest today. We'll look for you on television. Dear Prudence, by the way, is on the Hallmark Network this week. It's a movie that she recently did. The high cost of gasoline has begun to change people's tastes and habits. We're quickly falling out of love with our big cars. We're finding ways to cut down on our driving. We're also impatient as we wait for manufacturers to deliver cars that get better mileage. That may take a while, and if you're like a lot of people, you're not in a position to buy a new hybrid just now. So in the interim, what can you do to save money at the pump? Well, you could adopt some of the practices of hypermilers. These are people who are looking for every possible way to increase miles per gallon, and they are succeeding. Some of them claim that they can match the mileage of an equivalent hybrid. Wayne Gerdes coined the term hypermiler. Some say he's the king of the hypermilers. He's also the founder of and frequent contributor to cleanmpg.com, and he joins us for the remainder of the program. Thank you for being with us. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Mike. How you doing?
I'm great. You're in Wadsworth, Illinois. Where is that?
Halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee.
Okay. And the simplest question of the morning is going to be, what is hypermiling?
Well, hypermiling is a pretty easy term to describe. It's anybody that can beat the EPA number that's attached to their new vehicle from the time they drive it off the lot at the dealership to the time they trade it in or sell it to a private party, whatever. And it is relatively easy to do once you pick up the lingo and start to put the techniques to practice.
And I suppose if you go to cleanmpg.com, you can get a lot of the tips we'll be talking about today. Is that right?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
By all means.
I have noticed that since the price of gasoline shot up, there are a lot of people driving more slowly on the highway, starting off more slowly from traffic lights, coasting more. I've been doing this myself. When they see a yellow light ahead or a light that's already turned red, rather than using the gas until they absolutely have to use the brakes, is that what you're talking about here?
Well, it is, except there's another aspect to hypermiling, and that's being accountable down to, you know, every time you push on the accelerator pedal, what does it really cost you? And by having instrumentation that's actually giving you your fuel economy as you're driving down the road, not something you have to pay attention to every second, but it's something that you are mindful of more or approximately the same as your speedometer. But by having that accountability every time you turn the key to the time you turn your key off, you know what you're getting, and that will change your habits relatively quickly.
Hmm. Some people seem to be taking this to an extreme, though. Some of these hypermiling techniques I suppose could be dangerous in that they may impede the flow of traffic or even cause some road rage. Is that true, or is that just my own erroneous impression?
You've got some impressions, and of course the internet is a pretty big place, so a lot of stuff gets pushed out there. There are advanced techniques, but remember the main thing about hypermiling is staying in the right-hand lane down on the interstate between the speed limits and in what we call a ridge ride to make yourself noticeable. And if somebody has a problem with you being the only one legal within 50 miles, I think the road rage, there's nothing you can do about that individual.
Wayne Gerdes is our guest. He's the originator of hypermiling and the owner-operator of cleanmpg.com. We're going to take a break. I'm going to come right back and find out more about this new phenomenon in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Audi of Charlotte, featuring the 2008 A4 sedan and Avant wagon, available with 255 horsepower front track or quattro, Bluetooth, and more on the web at audiofcharlotte.com. And by Earthfair, a natural and organic market empowering people to make healthier choices for themselves, their communities, and generations to come. Now with three locations in the Charlotte area, including Morrison Road near South Park. It's the Friday, which means the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. Hour one is for the National News Hour, and they'll have a lot to talk about with the wrapping up of the Democratic National Convention last night and Barack Obama's speech in Mile High Stadium, or is that what it's called? Invesco Field at Mile High Stadium, and more. And, of course, a preview of the Republican National Convention, which may or may not open in St. Paul on Monday. There's some talk now about delaying it because of the hurricane approaching New Orleans. They don't want a rehash of Katrina. So we'll see what they talk about with regard to that in the first hour. Then at 11 o'clock, the International Hour, Tom Jelton, Michael Hirsch from Newsweek, and Moises Naim, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, will talk about the top international stories, including news about Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Russia, North Korea, and elsewhere around the globe. Lots to talk about. If you have questions about hypermiling, join us, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or charlottetalks at WFAE.org.
Every day, All Things Considered reports on the names you know.
Vice President Cheney all but dismissed.
Warren Buffett is well known as a shrewd and...
Chief Justice John Roberts did not participate.
And maybe some you don't.
Nabil Abu Rodena, Fatah lawmaker, says...
Nils Dallaire of the Global Health Council.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said...
The names behind the news, every weekday on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
If you're still driving a big SUV, you know that filling up that gas tank can be painful.
Yeah, your tank's only half full, and you've exceeded the limit on your credit card.
Well, we can help. Donate your old gas hog through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
Your donation will help this station pay for your favorite programs, and you'll get a tax deduction.
And here's how it works.
Check out WFAE.org for details about the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program and how you can support WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking to Wayne Gerdes in this part of the program, a hypermiler, the originator of the term hypermiling. We'll get into some of the details of how you can save gasoline, like fellow hypermilers, and perhaps you are one yourself. If you are and you have some tips or some questions about how you can improve your own techniques, call us, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE. So what are some of the things that you should not be doing to increase your mileage, and what are some of the things that you can easily do to increase your mileage, Wayne?
Well, when somebody says not do, a whole bunch of flags come up in my head, because there's a lot of things that you can do that are perfectly legal, and unfortunately some of the bigger entities in the country have been unsafe. For example, bringing your tires to max sidewall. It's printed emboldened right in the side of every tire manufactured or on any car in the United States. I'd recommend bringing them right to that immediately, and there's a number of reasons. One is rolling resistance decreases dramatically, so you do get a nice bump up in fuel economy. But two, you get more even wear, you get better traction, you even get better, and I should say, shorter braking distances in dry conditions.
But aren't you decreasing the amount of rubber on the road by hyperinflating these tires?
Well, you got to. We're not hyperinflating. We're going up to the maximum sidewall that's posted on the tire, and you don't just decrease the footprint, but you also still have the same mass over that footprint, so you don't lose any frictional forces, and that's where the problem comes in when you have marketing majors deciding that something's not right or not.
Hmm.
Mass on the smaller footprint will bring the same, in fact, shorter braking distances.
Is it a harder ride, a noisier ride, a less comfortable ride, or is it the same?
No, you'll have an increase in NVH, which we call noise, vibration, and harshness, but the benefits far outweigh the negatives. And the main thing is that when you go to your service center for oil change or whatever, mm-hmm. they put your tires at the door placard. The next day you're below. The next week you're below a little bit more. The next month you're below by quite a bit. 3-4 months down, you haven't changed your oil yet, you're way below. It's been estimated that 80% of the tires on the road are underinflated below even door placard.
So let me understand something here, Wayne. The door placard, the left-hand driver's side door, has all the recommended air pressures for your tires, and the tire itself has a recommended air pressure on the sidewall. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And they don't necessarily agree. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you go with the pressure listed on the tire.
I do, and I highly recommend it for everybody else. And I wanted to mention one other thing is when you see a tire that's been at door placard or below and it's driven maybe 80% of its life, usually the edges are worn off, chunks are missing, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a tire that's been at max sidewall for its life, usually it's lasted double the period. I've got a Honda Accord with over 105,000 still original tires on it.
Wow.
But the wear is even all the way across. Would you rather be driving a vehicle not only with tread but with even wear all the way across?
Wow.
Versus a tire that was at door placard with the edges all worn off, you know, for the last 10 or 15,000 miles of that tire, you've got not just a poor traction tire, but one that is getting into the zone that should have been replaced way early.
So how much have you been able to increase? You drive a Honda Accord, which probably gets fairly good mileage if you just drive it normally, but how much have you been able to increase it over the EPA estimates that were listed on the sticker when you bought the car?
Yeah, my vehicle's rated at 24 miles per gallon combined on the EPA, on the 08 EPA, and my lifetime over the vehicle is 48.5 miles per gallon. So I've saved about $10,000 in fuel. But in my case, it's not about the money. It's more about where we get our oil from and our addiction to it.
So
65% of it's imported, so we've got to do something about that.
So if I were driving behind you on the highway, would I know, or on the roads around town, would I know that you are hypermiling, or because would I become annoyed with you?
You could be, and it depends. It depends what type of personality you are and how much over the speed limits that you traverse. You know, like. Let's say you're going down the interstate and you like to be 5 over the speed limit. Well, what you're going to do is you're going to see me a half mile ahead in what we call a ridge ride. You're going to say, boy, that guy's offset in the lane. What's going on up there? As you get closer, you're going to say, well, I'm catching up to him, but, you know, maybe a 10 mile per hour differential. And then you're going to go around me and says, that guy was following the speed limits. You know, if somebody gets annoyed with you because you're not breaking the law like most of us do,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you can't do anything about that. But, we have techniques to try and avoid that. In fact, we have 4 of them, and ridge riding is just the first.
Explain ridge riding. Explain ridge riding to me.
Sure. What it is it's mainly a safety technique, and what you want to do is make yourself very noticeable out on the roadway. And by offsetting yourself to the right side of the right-hand lane, you are looking different than everybody else on the roadway because everybody's riding in their lane right down the center. By offsetting yourself, keys something in somebody's head that from behind, and I'm talking way behind, that there's something different about that guy up there, and it brings them back into your realm so that you're in control and not just hanging out there ready to get hit.
So it makes people look out for you.
Yes, and that's what I want to do. If I could wave big orange flags above the car, sure, that would make me even more safe. But ridge riding is the first step, and by following the limits or just below, you know, to make yourself noticeable. That way you can interact with traffic, they can interact with you, and you're not impeding one another.
Now, the goal here, as we've already said, is to beat the EPA estimates on the window sticker of the car when it was brand new. And from what I understand from what I've read about you and what you have to say about the EPA sticker is that the EPA estimates are wrong to begin with. They are underestimating. Are they underestimating or overestimating the mileage? They're underestimating it, aren't they?
Well, they are for a hypermiler, that's for sure. I have never been in a vehicle, not a single vehicle, where I can't smash that number. And we just have to change the mindset of everybody else to realize that, you know, I might have bought a 25-mile-per-gallon car, and I'm getting 20 miles per gallon, and I'm not sure why, and I hate going to the pump all the time. Once they start to pick up, you know, just a few of the techniques, they're usually up 20 to 30% within the first week or two. And then the numbers keep going up and up and up as they move on. And by the time they're an expert, they'll be looking at 40 miles per gallon out of the 20 mile per gallon car. So, hey, this is kind of fun in the summertime.
And, of course, these EPA estimates are for a brand spanking new car. I would think as the car ages, then perhaps the mileage estimates that the EPA stuck on the sticker might actually begin to resemble reality because unless you keep the car in tip-top shape, correct? So that's part of hypermiling is to keep the car in shape, right?
It is. But the EPA numbers, remember, they're done on a dynamometer. They're done with 100% gasoline, no ethanol-laced gasoline. The vehicles do have some break-in, but they're put into a box and held around 75 to 86 degrees, let's say. You know, it's almost perfect conditions to drive a vehicle on a dynamometer.
And no wind resistance.
You and I, yeah, we're driving with AC on. We're driving in the middle of winter. You know,
they do those tests without air conditioning running?
They used to.
Okay.
In 1985, they started making adjustments to two tests, and they were non-AC tests. They were just a city and a highway cycle. But in 2008, they changed. We've now got five tests, and one does include AC. And that AC test it hits the hybrids in particular and the smaller vehicles pretty hard.
So let's go through a couple of techniques here. You've already talked about driving at or just under the speed limit, and because you're going to be a hypermiler, you'll stay to the far right side of the road so that you can attract attention from people who will know that you're not the ordinary Joe on the road or Joanne on the road. You're doing something that they need to look out for.
That's correct.
They
need to look out for it. They should be following themselves. How about we put it that way?
Okay. All right. A couple of terms that I ran across yesterday when reading about this that I'd never heard of before. FAS, frequent auto stops. What is that?
It's a forced auto stop. And what that is Honda, with their hybrid system, they have a system, and then what it does is it auto stops. That means it shuts down the motor when you come to a stop or a light, or anytime you're slowing through 5 miles per hour, the engine will shut off on a Civic Hybrid, for example. Well, what you do in a non-hybrid is you follow the same tactic, except you have to use your key to do that. And in many locations in Europe, they're already starting to force it that you shut your motor off at railroad crossings and things like that. So basically all it is to stop idling, because up to 3%, even up to 4% of our fuel consumption just goes away by idling.
So you're saying that when you come to a stoplight, you should turn the engine off?
Not everyone, but those that you'll know that you'll sit there for a minute or two. Those are the ones you definitely want to say, hey, you know, it's time to shut down.
Because my question...
It takes about 7 seconds. Here it comes.
Because
7 seconds worth of fuel to restart a vehicle.
That was my question. Because these hybrid vehicles, the design of the starter system to restart the engine is very, very different. And it doesn't seem... If you've ever driven one, you obviously have, there's no ring when it cranks up.
No.
It just starts. So yep. If you're using an old key automobile, a standard automobile, there's going to be that extra energy, it would seem to me extra energy, to turn the engine over and to get it running. And to do that repeatedly at stoplights, don't you waste gasoline doing that?
No. And remember, it's only 5 to 7 seconds on a modern-day fuel-injected engine of fuel to get an engine started. And as long as your vehicle's well-maintained, you know, it's not 300,000 and it barely starts and you have to push start it down the driveway or something, you know, you can do this. But again, you don't want to do it at every single stop sign and stoplight. You want to do it at where it makes sense, where you're going to sit for a while. If you're going to, let's say, a Walmart, you don't want to sit in the front there and idle. Stay in the back and shut off and be done with it.
Okay.
If you're going through a McDonald's, you don't go through the drive through. Just pull in, stop, shut off, go in, come out, and you're done, and then you're off.
So if you are at a stop sign, you don't turn the engine off. You come to a complete stop, you make sure it's clear that you go, but you don't turn the engine off.
No, not in that case.
Okay.
But there are some advanced fast techniques. I just talked to you about the slow speed,
okay.
The no speed fast.
Okay. All right.
There's also a moving fast, and that one's a very advanced technique, and it can be illegal if it's downhill in a lot of jurisdictions, but in most cases you're not going downhill. And what you would do is while you're moving, let's say you saw a stop sign that's maybe a third of a mile ahead. There's nobody behind you. You shut down. Bring your key back to ignition too, to bring them back your safety equipment, and then coast in. That's a very advanced technique, and what you're doing is out hybriding a hybrid, but it's really advanced, and you have to know what your car is going
to
act like.
Do you have to be in neutral, or do you leave the car in drive?
No, in this case, you would be in neutral.
Okay.
Shut down, bring it up. But there's two methods here. If you are going to have to use the brakes, it's best to keep the engine running and go into what we call fuel cut. Most modern day fuel-injected engines will go in a fuel cut where when you're decelerating, you won't use any fuel, and you just keep shifting your automatic down from drive to 3 to 2 to 1 and keep your RPMs above, let's say, 1,200 RPM, and you will not use any fuel as you're slowing down, but you will slow down down very quickly because your engine is acting as a big air compressor engine brake.
Yeah, because if you turn the engine off, you lose the compression of the braking system, and or the power braking system, and it seems to me you'd also lose the power steering, wouldn't you?
Well, not in particular, and this is a misnomer. A lot of vehicles today have variable power systems in them.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're going to find is at highway speeds, you do not need any power steering. And whenever I have a journalist then for a clinic, we head out in the country roads, I put him into a fast at 50. I say, grab the steering with a one finger, and he does. And I said, now steer from lane to lane. And he does, and he says, well, the engine's off. And he says, you don't need power steering at speed.
Okay.
Power brakes also, they don't just disappear. You have four to five pumps before they disappear. So, again, you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But you have all your ABS, you have all your airbags, everything's back. And you can stop on them, and you'll stop just as fast as if your car wasn't on. However, you only have a limited amount of that. So if you're coming into a situation where there's traffic, you shouldn't perform a fast. You should just let off, go into fuel cut, and then shift down until you're actually stopped and you didn't use any fuel while you did stop.
Let's go through some other things very quickly here before we run out of time. Pulse and glide, what is that?
That's a wonderful little technique. It was created actually probably back in the 1930s in the Mobile One, the Mobile Fuel Economy Challenges. And what it was some guy figured out that if he floored his vehicle and he got up to speed and then he shut the engine off and coasted for, you know, 3/4 mile and then got down to 5 miles per hour and then floored it again, he would get better fuel economy, and it actually worked. But that's not how we perform pulse and glide today because we just don't have that kind of empty roadways. What you want to do is take a small differential, and let's say we were going down some suburban thoroughfare with 35-mile-per-hour limits through town. You might accelerate to 35, back down to 29, accelerate to 35, glide down to 29. And when you're gliding down in, for example, like a Prius, you would do that with the engine off.
Mm-hmm.
Just by the way you handle your foot on the accelerator pedal. And that's where it came from, and that's how it works so well in a Prius that going around town, a Prius that's already warmed up is a guaranteed 100 miles per gallon once you learn all the techniques that we use in one.
Driving without brakes.
That's an easy one, and that's something everybody should practice. And what it is imagine before you turn the key in the morning, you knew you had to get to point B, but you knew your brakes had a small problem. How would your habits change if you knew you didn't have all the brake capability that you normally do? You would instantly start anticipating stop signs and stoplights from traffic impediments and pedestrians from further back. And what it would do is make you a more aware, much more efficient driver because you wouldn't be using the brakes. You'd be coasting into those situations.
Would you also be downshifting? Is downshifting a waste of gasoline, or is it a good idea?
Downshifting is only a good idea is when you have to stop and you came into a situation and it was unplanned, then you would downshift, go into fuel cut, and you would keep downshifting until you're actually almost stopped.
I have about 30 seconds. What about drafting? A lot of NASCAR drivers draft. Is that a good idea for typical motorist?
No, and what you're going to find is that the hypermilers, they're on the interstate at 5 under, and there's nobody to draft anyway.
Wayne Gerdes is the person who coined the term hypermiler, which are ways to save gasoline, and you can find out more at his website, cleanmpg.com. Wayne, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it, too.
Okay. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And our program is made possible in part today by Bank of Granite, now offering Granite mobile banking for cell phone access to online accounts. Bank of Granite, now with state-of-the-art service as solid as our name, on the web at bankofgranite.com. And by Presbyterian Breast Centers, offering women early detection through digital mammography and advanced treatment options in the fight against breast cancer. Mammogram appointments at presbyterian.org/scheduling.
What does the future hold for an economy when a good chunk of the population is nearing retirement age?
our age group from 55 to 65 plus, we have about 32% of our workforce. And so you can see in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to lose the majority of our workforce.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. As the Republicans go to the Twin Cities, a look at the economy next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
6:30 to 7 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. Should you truly feed a fever and starve a cold? What about hydration? How many glasses of water should you really drink every day? If you shave your head, will your hair really grow back curlier than it was? Does eating turkey make you drowsy? If you use your cell phone at the hospital, are you really endangering the patient? We'll get to the bottom of these and other pieces of conventional medical wisdom in an encore presentation of Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. A sunny day ahead, upper 80s. For a high, and then tonight, upper 60s, around 90 tomorrow, and Sunday also sunny, upper 80s. Right now it's 77 degrees at listener-funded 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source.
From WAMU.